Well, good evening again. Welcome. I wanted to make a little clarification from last night. You may have to keep me around a night or two so I can get all my clarifications made. I said, several people asked me, what did I mean about being a blue-blooded Anabaptist? Well, I'm a person that loves words, and sometimes I just pull a word out that sounds good without maybe thinking of all the what it exactly means. So here's what I should have said, something like maybe I'm a diehard Anabaptist or maybe something along that line. What it did not mean, I am not one who glorifies my Anabaptist heritage. And in fact, when people do that, it kind of makes me feel ill. And I have great appreciation for it. But one thing I've noticed, sometimes the people that glorify their heritage the most aren't even following the heritage. And that really puts a kink in your in your spirit. We have adopted children, so it's hard for me to get excited about genealogies and bloodlines and so on. I mean, I have an interest around here when I figure out, you know, who's kin to who and all that. I do like that. But we aren't connected to Christ by bloodline. We're all adopted into the family. And so what I do mean is that the things that the Anabaptists stood for, the core things, I embrace those things. You know, for instance, separation of church and state, believers' baptism, communion, that sort of thing. So that's what I meant by that. Well, tonight I entitled the message, "And the Mule Went Away." Now, this isn't going to be a lesson on horseback riding. I'm not a horse rider. I've been on horses a few times, and it always seemed like they were a long way off the ground. And so this message is geared more toward last evening's message about surrender. Of course, that applies to all of us at whatever age, but especially to young people initially when they make the decision to surrender their life to Christ. This evening maybe is geared more for those of us a little bit older. You know, we look in our past and we look back and we say, yes, we remember when we surrendered to Jesus. But, you know, life gets busier. Maybe we get married. We have a family. The responsibilities grow heavier. We have to work to feed our families, and that's biblical. And so there's sort of a different set of pitfalls that can come to this age group. You know, you get to be 30 and 40 and right in that age group especially. And after a while, we maybe take stock of ourselves and we realize we're not as surrendered as we thought we were, or we've maybe been sidetracked. So the title to this message comes from the story of Absalom. And what a gut-wrenching story this is. And it got me to thinking about how when we have self-centered ambitions and dreams, and, you know, people have those, and some people spend their whole lives reaching for that dream, and it ends up, when they get to the end of their life, it ends up leaving them hanging and unfulfilled. And so for those of you that are still young enough to, you know, be able to make some changes, you know, now's the time to think about those things. You know, things like power and pleasure and riches, those are actually the three things I want to talk about. And there's a sad statement that I've heard that goes like this. How tragic to spend your whole life climbing the ladder. You know, we use that term, climbing the ladder, and then get to the end of life and realize you're on the wrong ladder. That's a very sad thing. You know, there's no time to crawl back down and get on the right ladder. And so I'm trying to think how in the King James it says, "And the mule went away when Absalom got hung in the tree." And so that's where the title comes from. Absalom was a young man so full of promise and potential. I want to see what it says about him in 2 Samuel 14. And by the way, it's hard to know what to use for a text when there's a story that goes over multiple chapters. And so we're just going to pull out a few sections here and there. But in 2 Samuel 14, it says, "Now in all Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him." So he was just, what do you call somebody like Absalom? A man's man. He was really something. And just a little side note, it's not always a, being handsome isn't always a an asset. I've seen, you know, handsome men that people look up to, and it doesn't end up doing them well. I never had that problem, so I don't know from experience. But but Absalom had his heart set on the kingdom. He had great dreams. He wanted the kingdom. He wanted to be in charge. Where did he end up? He ended up under a heap of stones. Now, when I say it's a gut-wrenching story, that's a gut-wrenching story right there. So this evening, we want to look at several misguided ambitions that can waste and ruin a person's life. You know, we look back in the Old Testament and we kind of marvel and shake our heads at how God's chosen people, how so often they fell into idolatry. And we'd say, those poor people, you know, we'd never be like them, would we? And yet, can't misguided and improper ambitions and appetites just as clearly be idolatry? Sure they can. And I want to say, I wouldn't be surprised if America today isn't one of the most idolatrous nations on earth. And you don't see that many images around and so on, but the things people worship and give their lives for today, there's a lot of idolatry going on. So we can't nearly read all this story, but you know the story. Absalom was instrumental in killing his brother Amnon, and then he fled, and how David's heart yearned for his son, but he didn't do anything about it. And I just want to say that in situations, doing nothing is an option, but usually it doesn't bring very good results. Usually there's something positive we should do. And I wonder if this whole story could have turned out differently if David would have been reconciled to his son early on. But Absalom fled for a couple years, and then Joab was instrumental. Joab was a rascal, but he tried to do some things, and he was instrumental in getting Absalom back home. But it says he came back home, but he didn't go see his dad. David didn't ask to see him. He just went down to his house. And Absalom said, "Well, you know, this is no good." And it wasn't until Absalom had Joab's barley fields burned up, that he arranged for Absalom to come see David. So finally there was this supposed reconciliation. And David kisses Absalom, and on the surface things look better. But underneath, Absalom has these big plans. And the reason he needed to be at peace is because he needed to be back home so he could develop this following that he wanted, so he could at some point take the kingdom. He needed to be in Jerusalem for those plans to develop. Now, Absalom was an amazing politician, I would say. A good politician knows how to play his cards. He knows when to hold them close and be patient, and he knows when to deal them, when to play his hand. And in Absalom's case, he would get up early and he would stand by the city gate. And, you know, people were coming into the city and he didn't even let people, you know, people would get ready to bow down to him. And after all, Absalom was maybe almost like an idol. You know, he was the most handsome man in the kingdom. And people would get ready to bow down and he wouldn't let them. And he'd grab them and he'd kiss them in the custom of the day. And, you know, like treating him like an equal. And he listened to their stories. He sympathized with them. And he said, you know, if there's nobody to hear your case, you know, the king is too busy. And if I were able to hear your case, I would get you justice. And it says he stole the hearts of the people of Israel. And this is a little side note here to leaders. And I would say this, listen to your people. Hear their hearts. If you don't, they'll turn to someone who will listen. And the results aren't always what we'd like to see, aren't always positive. And that's one thing. This is another, I maybe get off track on too many side notes. This is one thing I really like about what I would call the congregational church model, where you do things together. There's interaction between leaders and the people, and you talk about things. And I think when things get too large and too compartmentalized, and some of that connection gets lost, some of these things can happen. May not be healthy. So 4 years go by, Absalom has felt like, well, I want to read. We should read the little scripture. 2 Samuel 15. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. He put on a show. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were the judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. And so Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. And so this went on for 4 years. I don't know why David didn't realize what was going on. And finally, after 4 years, Absalom feels like he has enough support that he can take the kingdom. And he asked permission from David to go to Hebron to fulfill a vow, he says. And from there, it's proclaimed that Absalom is king. And David flees for his life. So what is Absalom's inordinate ambition? I think it was power. And the ambition was so strong that he was willing to have his own father killed to fulfill his dream. You know, sometimes, like they say, the truth is stranger than fiction. When Ahithophel was giving Absalom advice in chapter 17, moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king, and I will bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. What a terrible thing that Absalom's dream had gotten so big and so overtaken him that it seemed right to him to go out and kill his father to be able to take the kingdom. Now, there's one thing else I should say before we go further. Part of this story is about Absalom and his lust for power. Another part of the story is about David's reaping for his sin. Do you remember that? Back in chapter 12, it says, Nathan the prophet is talking to David, and he says, "Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and have them and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." So God has this way of, you know, things work together. You know, one man does one thing, and it's a reaping for another man for something else. And so part of that was reaping. And we see the terrible consequences of sin. Well, back to our story. It's time for the showdown. And that takes place, we know the story, in chapter 18. And how Absalom was riding through the forest on his mule in verse 9 or verse 8 in chapter 18. And the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, and he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him went on. And then we know the story how David had commanded, "Don't harm my son Absalom." But like I said, Joab, the rascal that he was going to take his own revenge. And Absalom was killed there in the tree. And they took him and threw him into a pit in the forest and raised up. This is at verse 16. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. And all of Israel fled, everyone to his own home. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley. For he said, "I have no son to keep my name in remembrance." And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. So Absalom ended up having two monuments. One, the one that he set up for himself, and the other, the great heap of stones that they raised over him. Talk about the mule a little bit. The mule seemed to be a symbol of royalty. And you know, when Amnon was killed, and it says all the king's sons mounted their mules and fled. And I wonder if the mule wasn't kind of like the Mercedes that the Saudi Arabian princes drive. And contrast that with Jesus. It says he rode into the city on a donkey's colt. Zechariah says, "Behold, your king is coming to you, humble, mounted on a donkey." So Absalom's mule went away and left him hanging by his head in the tree. Maybe if he'd have been a little more humble, maybe if he'd have been just riding a donkey, that little bit of elevation would have been enough to keep him out of the tree. Maybe his head would have slid right under that oak. But the mule went away, and just like that, all his ambitions and all his dreams went away as well. Let's not have a lust for power. The history books, I told you before, one of the subjects I did enjoy in school was history. The history books are full of men that had a lust for power. How did most of them end up? Most of them pretty much like Absalom. I'm thinking of the ones kind of in recent history: Hitler of Germany, Mussolini of Italy, Ceausescu of Romania, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. That just scratches the surface of history. That's just recent history. You think about all those, how they ended up. Not good. And we'll see in 20 years what the history books say about Putin and his lust for power. When there's a lust for power, people always suffer. And the ratio can be astounding. One man can develop a lust for power, and a whole country can suffer. Like in the case of Hitler, almost the whole world suffered because of the lust of power of one man. And, you know, the men I've just mentioned were rulers of countries, but the desire for power doesn't stop there. Sad to say, sometimes it rears its ugly head in churches. Sometimes it shows itself in homes where the husband and the father leaves behind the role of the shepherd, being a shepherd leader, and changes into a domineering dictator. Let's never let the lust of power be named among us. A couple years ago, I was talking to a brother in Pennsylvania, and he was telling about this church. I don't even know where it is, so I can't point any fingers. But they were concerned, the congregation was concerned, because I think it was the bishop. It seemed like they weren't heard, and there was no place for them to say how they felt. And so they kind of got a little group together and somebody to represent them, and they went to the bishop and said, it just seems like we're on a bus going on a trip, and you're the driver, and like we're just along for the ride. And the bishop said, that is the way it is. That's a sad commentary on the Bible uses shepherd so many times when it talks about leading. And we had sheep for a couple years, and we don't anymore, but that couple years with sheep was like a worship experience for me. I'd watch those sheep. I'd never been around sheep. And some of the scripture became alive. And you can't chase sheep. If you try to chase them, you get them so far and they squirt out in every direction. And the sheep learned to know me. And now I don't like to holler, but I got this little horn, and I'd go out and I'd blow this horn, and every head in the pasture would come up. And here they'd come, most of the time. And sometimes it was so far away that I'm sure they couldn't even see me. They were down through one field, across the creek, up another field. You lead the sheep. You don't approach it from the position of power. The second thing I want to look at is the lust for riches. Now, I want to be clear when I start in here. You don't have to have money to have this problem. I've seen very poor people that had a lust for riches. And, of course, rich people can have that problem too. Jesus told the story in Luke 12. I'm watching the clock. In Luke 12, beginning at verse 16. And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. There I will store.'" Wait a minute, I'm going to start over. I want to emphasize something when I read this. The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, "What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops." And he said, "I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain." No, not all my grain and my goods. "And I will say to my soul, 'You have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, drink, and be merry.'" You pick up on something there? A very, very self-centered man. But God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" So it is. So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So back up at the beginning of the parable, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. Had he gotten any trouble yet? No. We all hope for plentiful crops. And even when he said, what shall I do? I have nowhere to store my crops. Would it be anything necessarily wrong with tearing down your barns and building larger ones? Maybe not. If you had the idea, I'm going to build bigger barns and I'm going to store my crops and I'm going to look around all over the countryside and I'm going to see who is needy that I could help. That would have been great. But where he got in trouble is where he said, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. That's where he ran into trouble. Beware of the lust for riches. Businessmen, beware. Young men, beware. I've heard some young men talking lately, not here, of what they want to do. You know, they're still in school now, but, you know, yeah, they're thinking about going into this, and they've heard, you know, the pay is this. And that's okay, but don't make that the only thing you're going after. Let God lead you and pay is not the only thing out there. Wage earner, beware. Greed is an equal opportunity employer. Like I said, sometimes the man with nothing can have big problems with the love for money that he doesn't have. And I know in business, you have to have a margin of profit to sustain a business, but it's not all that hard for that desire for reasonable profit to slip into a lust for money. And I want to tell you a little story about a man I knew growing up. His name was Mr. Burdell, and my dad worked for him. Mr. Burdell was a businessman, and this story made a lasting impression on me. You know how sometimes there's something that happens in your life that's just a life, it's kind of like a guidepost that guides you the rest of your life. This story is one of those. My dad worked for Mr. Burdell. He had bought up a bunch of land. There's a plantation in our area, Whitehall Plantation. And at one time, it was like 30,000 acres. And it got sold off. So he bought the house and some of the land, and he was trying to buy more. I think he ended up finally about 1,000 acres. And he farmed, I think, just for a tax write-off. But my dad worked from when I was like 11, 12, 13, right along in there. He was a shrewd businessman. Now, I don't know if he ever did anything actually illegal, but, you know, there's ways of legally taking advantage of people. If you know the ropes and if you have the money and if you know the right people. And when he was trying to buy up some of this land to add to his plantation, there was some family land that bordered that used to be part of it. And he went to the family and said, I'd like to buy this land. They said, well, it's tied up in however many heirs. And Mr. Burdell said, well, you know, don't worry. I'll take care. I'll get the lawyers and we'll go to all the heirs and we'll work it out. And I'll just take it off the amount of the land when we're done. Well, what they didn't realize was that it pretty much used up all the money to pay all the lawyers to get all this done. And when it was all said and done, the family got basically nothing. And it was all legal, but it wasn't very nice. And he eventually sold the farm when he got older. He moved to Lynchburg. And there was a man in our church at the time that did remodeling work. And so he did some work in Mr. Burdell's house and learned to know him. And then a couple years after that, Mr. Burdell was in the hospital and he was on his deathbed. And Dave, that was the guy's name. Anybody here know Dave Gingrich? A few people. Yeah, if you know Dave Gingrich, he's a one of a kind. Anyway, Dave went to see Mr. Burdell in the hospital. And you know, you would think, what would you think a man would want to talk about? He said, Dave, you've got to help me. You've got to help me live till the first of the year. What would you suppose a man on his deathbed would want to talk about? Maybe he needed help in finding the people that he should apologize for to, where he dealt so shrewdly with. Or maybe he wanted some time to make peace with his maker. That wasn't what he was. It had something to do with money. If he could live till the first of the year, there was a tax benefit or something that he could get. I don't remember if he lived to the first of the year or not. How incredibly sad that is. You would think on your deathbed, money would be the very last thing on your mind. But I think it goes to show, if something gets to be your game and that's what you live for, you can get sucked in so deep that somehow reality doesn't sink in. So let's not get sucked into the lust for riches. It'll blind our eyes to the real purpose and meaning of life. And I also have to think of Judas. You know, of all men, I think Judas wouldn't he be probably the most despised man, one of the most despised men on planet Earth? You know, we would look at him almost like the devil. The epitome of evil. I want to throw out a little different slant on Judas. This is just my imagination again. Do you think he loved Jesus? I think he did. I think it's obvious in the depth of his remorse after he betrayed him. He did love Jesus. I think he thought that Jesus could walk away unharmed. He had done it every time before. And he'd just have an easy 30 pieces of silver. I think Judas loved Jesus. The problem was he just loved money a little bit more. Now we think we'd never be like Judas, but it's not that hard to love something just a little bit more than we love Jesus. The third and last thing I want to look at is the lust for pleasure. And the story of the prodigal son illustrates this very well. And we won't read it. We're running out of time. You know, the younger son squandered his estate on pleasure. But pleasure for pleasure's sake ends up being very empty. And it's a gas guzzler on finances. And in the young man's case, it was all gone. And he began to be in want. And hunger has an amazing way of bringing you to your senses. But the beautiful thing about this story, as opposed to the two stories we've looked at and the illustrations I gave, is that the prodigal son came to his senses. And he came to his senses in time to retrace his steps and fall at the feet of his father, who had the power to restore his life. For Absalom, he had no time to change the course of his life. Now, maybe he came to his senses hanging there in that tree and pled to God for mercy, but he had no time to make changes. In the case of the rich fool, there was no time at all. God said, boom, you know, this night your soul's required of you. Mr. Burdell, I don't know. He could have come to his senses just before he died. But like Absalom, he had no time to make any amends or any changes in the way he had lived his life. And so that's the same beautiful thing that we have, us today. We're here. We have our life and we have our breath. And we have the time. We don't know how much. But we have the time to focus on directing our lives in a God-honoring way. What a privilege we have. We don't need to come to the end of our lives and be full of regret over how we lived it. If we see we're climbing up the wrong ladder, we have time to come down and allow God to lead us to the right one. If our priorities are out of whack, we can come to our senses and make the needed changes. And let's not just, this is a bit of a negative message tonight. And we don't just want to focus on the negatives. A person that has his life surrendered to Jesus Christ, like we've been talking about, and buys into the positives that come from a life yielded, surrendered to Jesus, if our hearts and affections are gung-ho there, it's unlikely that these wrong affections will get a hold of us. So let's not ride a mule that is going to go away and leave us hanging. A life totally surrendered to Jesus Christ is the only life worth living. And we've been invited to a banquet. Luke 14. A man was giving a banquet and he invited his friends and his neighbors. And you know the story. One man said, "I bought a field, I can't come." One man said, "I've bought a 5 yoke of oxen and I can't come." Another said, "I've married a wife and I can't come." I think the last one had the best excuse. But we don't want to get so entangled that we don't have time to go to the banquet. Let's all examine ourselves. I have a really good wife, by the way. And she's put up with a lot with me, and I put up with a few things, but we are polar opposites, but we've been good for each other. Don't let that distract you. Let's not get entangled with these ambitions and dreams that take us away, that pull us away from where we want to be. God bless you.